This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Like it or not, you are a negotiator. Negotiation is a fact of life. That's how the 1981 best-selling book Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In, begins. Getting Yes was co-authored by Harvard Law professor Roger Fisher, who devoted most of his life to studying and resolving conflicts around the world. He's widely known as the founding father of the conflict resolution field and the co-founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project.
Roger Fisher passed away last Saturday at the age of 90, but his legacy survives in big and important ways, from contract disputes between school systems and teachers' unions to political stalemate in Washington to the decades old challenge of reaching peace in the Middle East. Skilled negotiation remains essential.
And no one embodied that skill more than Roger Fisher. From resolving border disputes between Ecuador and Peru to working for peace in El Salvador to confronting apartheid in South Africa, Fisher helped rewrite the book, literally, on how to negotiate. Here's Roger Fisher in a 2010 interview for Mediate.com.
So it's an assumption to emphasize the differences we have and not the process for dealing with those differences. One process, of course, is litigation. But another process is understanding and talking and exploring how we can work on this together, how we can build on that if you can.
So we're going to spend a little time today talking about Roger Fisher and the art of negotiation. He believed that negotiation is almost always better than war, that reaching agreement required separating the people from the problem. And he challenged the orthodoxy that you should never negotiate with terrorists or hostage takers. And while his focus was global, his principles can help people reach agreements at home, at work, or in their marriages.
And joining us now are two people who studied and worked with Roger Fisher and knew him well. William Urey was co-author with Fisher and Bruce Patton of Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In, which is now in its third edition. And Bill Urey, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Also with us here in the studio is Irma Tyler Wood. She's co-founder and partner of the Cambridge ThoughtBridge consulting firm and a high-level negotiations expert. Irma Tyler Wood, great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bill Urey, let me start with you. Tell us first something about Roger Fisher and what made him tick. Where did this commitment and passion for negotiation come from?
Well, as Roger used to say, he was a student at Harvard during in the 40s and fought in World War II, and his roommate and two of his best friends died in that war and left him with a commitment to see if we could find a better way of dealing with our differences generally in the world than killing each other. And I think that's where it came from. And Roger really epitomized that himself. He devoted himself night and day to seeing if the world could come up with better ways to deal with our differences.
How did the best-selling book Getting to Yes come about? In 1981, it becomes a bestseller. It's now in its third edition. It seems incredibly relevant today. You were one of the co-authors with Roger Fisher. How did it come to be?
Well, let me just share a quick anecdote about how I came to work with Roger.
Please do, yes.
It was one evening in very cold winter in Cambridge, in Boston there in January 77, I was studying for my graduate student exams in anthropology, and late at night, I received a call in my rented attic room that served as a kind of bedroom and office, and it said, "This is Roger Fisher, and I've just read your research paper, which was proposing an anthropological study of the Middle East peace negotiations," and he said, I liked it so much, I sent the paper in the main table to the Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East for him to have a look at, and I'd like you to come work with me. And I was absolutely stunned. I'd never expected a professor to call me up, let alone invite me to collaborate or see one of my ideas offered up for practical application.
That must have been thrilling.
It was, and as I later came to learn, it was vintage Roger. It was enthusiastic, generous, bold, practical, idealistic all at once. And I can honestly say my life has never been the same since. That call. And so that led to working with Roger for 4 or 5 years, in the course of which he invited me to work with him on interviewing international diplomats on the practice of international mediation. And he and I compiled a handbook that was called International Mediation, a working guide. And at one point, I was talking with Roger and said, you know, the audience for that handbook, I mean, it was a good handbook, but the audience for that handbook was about five. I mean, there are not that many international mediators, particularly in that era. And so, you know, I proposed to him, I said, why don't we turn this into a more general book, you know, rewrite it for negotiation generally for everyone. And he agreed. And so that was the kind of the genesis of couple years worth of work together with him and Bruce Patton, and the result was Getting to Yes.
And we're going to talk a lot about what's in that book, Getting to Yes, because it seems to me that it's still so current and so needed in this world today. But first, Irma Tyler Wood, I'd love to get you in on this conversation and tell us how you came to know Roger Fisher.
I was a student at Harvard Law School and heard from my civil procedure professor that 90% of the cases lawyers argue never get tried in a court. You have to sit down and negotiate. So I signed up for the course that Roger taught. And for me, it was as if a light bulb went off. It made sense not only in terms of how I wanted to practice law, but how I wanted to be in the world as a human being.
And what was it? What was that light? What was the source of that light bulb that went off?
I think there were two sources. One was a structured framework that looked not only at your needs and what you wanted as a way to resolve conflict, but also very much at the needs of the other person and really getting to know that other person almost better than you know yourself. The other was that law school, they used to say to us when I was a student, you're not really learning to practice law here. But this framework actually taught you how to resolve conflict. So it wasn't just theory. There were practical things that I could take and did apply even before I left the law school.
And if I understand correctly, you actually did had an opportunity to apply some of these principles with Roger Fisher in South Africa. Is that correct?
Yes, I got to go to South Africa at the same time Roger did. He went to Johannesburg to the negotiations, which were in crisis. The word, as I understand it, was that the far right was threatening to withdraw from the negotiations rather than and go to war rather than resolve what they hoped to do. And Roger had been taking students back and forth for, 10 years, going back and forth, training people. And I got sent to a little township, retreat center outside of Johannesburg called Vilgus Pruit. I think that's how they pronounced it. And I had in the room with me 30 people, black and white, who had all been trained, at least one day of training in negotiation from Roger, who had been either funneling people over to train them or bringing them over to the Harvard Negotiation Project.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And tell us what happened. I mean, what was the effect? I mean, did it work? What did you see happen there because of what he was able to do?
Well, as an American coming into a very different culture, I thought, I think this stuff works. How do they feel? So I started the workshop by saying to the 30 people, all of you have had at least one day of training, and you've come back for 3 days of advanced training. Why have you come back? And I heard probably the most powerful answer I've ever heard. A man sitting to my right raised his hand. He said, I am a taxi driver, and I live in a township that has a single road. As such, I transport people back and forth to Johannesburg. He said, as you know, the South African government has been fomenting conflict between the various factions, ANC, Inkatha Freedom Party, etc. He said, one day, the bullets started flying across that road. Nobody could get to school. Nobody could get to work. I couldn't earn my living. He said, I took what I had learned in that one day of training, and because I am ANC, first I went to the Inkatha Freedom Party side of the road and talked with them. He said, and then I went to my side of the road and talked with the ANC folks. He said, and then I brought us together, and together we stopped the bullets from flying. So he said, I figured if I could do that with one day of training, what could I do with three? And this was a man with limited education, but he had taken that training and made a difference. And it just confirmed for me the power of what Roger was teaching.
Well, Bill Urey, I want to talk about some of the power of what Roger Fisher and you and Irma Tyler Wood are all talking about, have all been dealing with for a while. I was reading Getting to Yes last night, and early in the book, it talks about the pitfalls of something called positional bargaining. And this will sound familiar to a lot of us. It could be a negotiation over a contract, a family quarrel, or a peace settlement. each side takes a position and argues for it. And here's the example from the book, which we have rendered for the radio. So listen to this. This was done with help from our producer, Shannon Dooling, and reporter David Boeri.
So how much do you want for this brass dish?
Beautiful antique, isn't it? I could let it go for $75.
Oh, come on. It's dented. I'll give you $15.
Really? I might consider a serious offer. $15 isn't serious.
Well, I could go to $20, but I would never pay anything like $75, so quote me a realistic price.
Realistic? Okay. You drive a hard bargain. $60 cash right now.
$25.
Cost me a great deal more than that. Make me a serious offer.
$37.50. That's the highest I will go.
Have you noticed the engraving on this dish, by the way? Next year, pieces like this are going to be worth twice as much as what you're telling me you'll pay me today.
So, Bill Urey, you'll recognize that, and apologies to you and to the late Roger Fisher. That was lifted right out of Getting to Yes. But it's an example of positional bargaining. It may lead to an agreement. It may not. What's wrong with that kind of negotiation?
Well, in certain circumstances, it's fine. But, you know, usually we're dealing with, you know, 95% of our negotiations are with people with whom we have ongoing relationships. It's our spouse, it's our kids, it's our, you know, coworkers, it's our neighbors, and so on. And if you use positional bargaining, you usually end up with a suboptimal agreement because you're not getting at the underlying interest. You're not dealing with why is it, you know, that people want something. I mean, you know, like the proverbial, you know, quarrel about two children quarreling over an orange, and you know, they quarrel about the orange, and they say, okay, positionally, okay, we'll just split in half, and one sister takes her half and peels it and eats the fruit, and the other sister takes her half, throws away the fruit, and uses the peel for baking a cake. In other words, you end up with a half a peel for one and a half a fruit for the other, when if you really understood the underlying interests and needs, which are in eating and cooking, then you might end up with a whole peel for one and a whole fruit for the other. It's also, positional bargaining is also inefficient. It can also hurt the relationship as each party kind of digs in and refuses to budge, and you may end up with a 3-year contract dispute.
There was a great example that was offered to us in an email exchange with Bruce Patton, your co-author, who said Roger was incredibly creative, constantly coming up with options no one else considered. Here's a quick example. On Cyprus, the Turkish Cypriots claimed 40% of the island, the Greeks 80%. Roger said, why not give them both what they want? But that adds up to more than 100%. So he said it just means they have to share 20%, which they did for years. So, I mean, that's an example of his kind of thinking. And if it's not positional bargaining, Bill Urey, what is it? I mean, what's the alternative?
It's interest-based negotiation. It's negotiation based at addressing the core interests of each side in a way that each side can walk away with their core interests satisfied. And it just makes for better ongoing relationships, better deals, and much more efficient than positional bargaining on the whole.
So give us an example in the real world where you saw that work, principled negotiation.
Well, I'll give you another example, you know, from Camp David, the first Camp David, which was the negotiation between Egypt and Israel over the Sinai Peninsula, which Israel had occupied. And that was something where Roger and I and others had some small role in contributing to, but essentially a little bit similar to the one you're talking about with Cyprus. Essentially, you know, they were arguing about where to draw the line in the sand, and the Israelis were demanding, you know, a third to a quarter of the Sinai, saying they, you know, they absolutely would refuse to budge, and the Egyptians saying, no, we want all of it. They were focused on their positions. But the genius of looking behind positions for interest revealed that, in fact, you know, why do you want to keep a third of the Sinai to the Israelis? Well, it was security. I mean, Egyptian tanks had rolled across the Sinai and attacked them. They didn't want that happening again. If you ask the Egyptians what their interest was, it was sovereignty. I mean, the land had been there since the time of the pharaohs. By focusing on the underlying interest, then you could say, okay, how do we meet the Israeli interest in security while also addressing the Egyptian interest in sovereignty? And there you came up with a creative idea, which was a demilitarized Sinai. In other words, 100% of the Sinai goes back to Egypt. The Egyptian flag could fly everywhere, and the Israelis get a buffer of the entire Sinai instead of a third. So both sides benefited, and the U.S. actually played that intermediary role both at the negotiating table and in maintaining, you know, a kind of a Sinai monitoring mission to make sure that, you know, that the whole thing was demilitarized. And it's worked up till now.
Listeners, we're talking about the legacy of Roger Fisher. We've got his co-author of Getting to Yes, Bill Urey, here in the studio, as well as Irma Tyler Wood, who was a student of Roger Fisher's. What's your view on the importance of negotiation? Have you read Getting to Yes, and are you aware of Roger Fisher and his contribution to negotiation? Do you have any questions about the effectiveness of negotiation? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Irma Tyler Wood, I wanted to ask you about a couple of other principles that show up in Getting to Yes that Roger Fisher talked about. One important principle is disentangling people from the problem. And the idea is you can be kind to the people, but tough on the problem, right?
Yes.
But what if the people are the problem?
If the people are the problem, then you don't start by trying to negotiate anything. And that's one of the lessons I've learned from my experience, is if you start by working on communication and the relationship and addressing the issues that have gotten in the way in the past and discussing them, not with the goal of attacking or blaming, but saying, given our history, how do we make sure we don't repeat the same mistakes? And you can do that by developing ground rules. You can bring in a third party to facilitate certain tough issues. But you start by looking not at the substance of what you want, but about how are we going to talk in a way that is productive.
Yeah.
And I've seen people, we actually had a client who'd been negotiating 2.5 years, and they said, we don't like each other, we don't trust each other, but we need a deal. And what we did was say, the first thing you all are going to have to do is unpack all the elephants, the history and things that have gotten in the way. Once they did that, they were able in a week's time to get an agreement that they hadn't been able to get for 2.5 years. So you address relationship by talking explicitly about what has gone wrong in the past, what do we need to do differently going forward, and what ground rules will we need to govern this discussion.
Hmm. Bill Urey, one of the more provocative things in Getting to Yes, and I want to talk to both of you and Irma about this, is the question, should we negotiate, can we negotiate with terrorists or hostage takers? And we hear again from our political leaders that no, 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 under no circumstances, because it will only encourage more terrorism and hostage taking. But in Getting to Yes, you and Roger Fisher argued otherwise. And as an example, you cite the resolution of the Iranian hostage crisis in 1981, for example.
Yeah, it's a tough one for sure. But the reality is that every government on the planet, the Israelis included, even those who say that they don't talk with terrorists, actually end up talking with them. Why? Because talking doesn't necessarily mean making concessions. It's making concessions that actually rewards the terrorism. Hmm. Talking gives you more information about them to figure out what's going on for them, to see if we can influence them more effectively, both violently and nonviolently. You know, in other words, we need to have that information. We need to have that information. And so if you don't talk, it's a little bit like trying to negotiate with one hand tied behind your back. You know, if you don't, you absolutely need to listen. And this is why, you know, take hostage negotiations in Boston or in New York. I mean, 30 years ago, you know, the main traditional way was, you know, John Wayne style. You know, someone's taking the hostages. You kind of, you know, you say, you got bullhorn, you've got 2 minutes to come up with your hands up or we're going in, and then tear gas and guns blazing, and often as not, people are dead. And now they have skilled hostage negotiation teams that go in, and what do? They listen. They talk. They talk to people whose behavior is absolutely, you know, reprehensible, but they talk. They listen. They even show, their first principle is show a little bit of respect, because get into their minds and their heads. And 99% of the time, the hostages are released, the hostage taker is taken into custody through a much more effective way of actually talking and listening.
Let's get a couple of listeners who have been waiting patiently to get in on this conversation. Amra is calling from Framingham. Hi, Amra, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question relates to the example that the guest had given about the Camp David Accords. An unintended consequence of the demilitarization of the Sinai, as we've seen in the news, is now that there's no military presence or a reduced military presence on the part of Egypt, we now see a lot more lawlessness there. And as we heard a while back, some church members from the Boston area had been kidnapped, and you hear about increase in terrorism in the area. So I was wondering what the guests thought about unintended consequences of these kind of negotiations.
Sure, I think that's a great question. Without going too deeply down the rabbit hole of the situation in the Middle East, Bill Urey, a general response about unintended consequences.
Yeah, there can be. And what that means is that, you know, once you reach an agreement, you have to be ready to reopen the agreement and renegotiate. And in this case, particularly, you know, the Israelis and the Egyptians need obviously to come to terms and maybe look at the terms of it so that they can actually increase security for both sides.
Hmm. Irma Tyler Wood, what about applying these principles to our private lives? I mean, we're talking about sort of global conflict resolution here, and that was obviously Roger Fisher's focus. But at home, in our marriages, at work, do these principles, are they just as valuable?
Absolutely. I was doing some work with a group of physicians who had spent about 10 years and $24 million suing each other. And after they learned the model, one of the physicians came in the next day and he said, you know, I sat down with my teenage daughter and for the first time, we really had a constructive conversation. Hmm. So the principles apply personally, internationally, certainly in business and government.
Mm, interesting. And, you know, Bill Urey, when this book was first written, and I'm talking about Getting to Yes, this was 1981. It wasn't a wide, I think you made reference to this at the beginning of the segment. There weren't a lot of people sort of thinking about negotiation as a sort of art that people were practicing, right?
That's right. There were hardly any classes being given in universities or law schools or corporations, for that matter, in negotiation. And now, you know, it's hard to find a law school, a business school, a school of government, or a corporation, large corporation, where they don't offer this because it's understood now to be an absolutely core competence in every day, from the moment we get up in the morning to the moment we go to bed at night, in the informal sense of the term at least, we're negotiating. We're trying to reach agreement with people, and we have some interests which are in tension, some interests which are shared. And you know, like it or not, as you said, we are all negotiators.
And probably more so in the way that the world is more and more interconnected, that gets talked about again and again. Is negotiation more important today than it was back in 1981 when this book first came out, Irma Tyler Wood?
I would say it is absolutely more important because we really do live in a global society and we can communicate at all levels in ways that we were never able to do before because of technology. And we can do great damage in the failure to communicate adequately and accurately. So if we could just take the resources we've spent on war and use those to build schools and roads and all of the really important resources that countries need, we would have turned the world in a very different direction.
Bill Urey, we literally have 30 seconds left, but I'm wondering if you ever get discouraged. I mean, are there situations where negotiation just doesn't work? And I'm thinking about, I don't know, Washington doesn't seem like a place these days where there's a whole lot of fruitful negotiation going on, for example.
Right. Yes, there are situations where negotiation doesn't work right now, but that doesn't mean it's not going to work later, and we have to work. I mean, there's no question right now it's a win-lose game in Washington, but for the sake of the country and for the sake of everything that we care about, we need to learn to work together, even as we oppose each other. I mean, negotiation is not just about cooperating. It's about cooperating while you're competing, and that's what Democrats and Republicans both need to learn.
All right. Well, that's a good message to end the segment on. William Urey, co-author with Roger Fisher, who died on Saturday, and Bruce Patton of Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Irma Tyler Wood, co-founder and partner of the Cambridge ThoughtBridge consulting firm. She was a student of Roger Fisher. Thank you very much for coming in today. We appreciate
it. Thank you for inviting me.
There's more coming up. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.